Before I end this speaker, I'd like to, first of all, just say that I know that they'll get what's coming to them, what's due coming to them, but I'd like to say the program committee has done one hell of a job. And also, I'm grateful to be clean today. About 3 years ago, I guess, I think at Ripley, West Virginia, I got a chance to hear this gentleman share, and it's had a real impact. I don't know the man real good. I just heard his message, and it was a clear, strong message of Narcotics Anonymous, the steps and the traditions. I don't know what he's going to do tonight. I don't know what he's going to share with you, but I'm sure what it is, it'll be good. And you know, it's made an impact on what I have believed and learned about the steps. And he has a way about how he shares that has really touched me. I don't know, I just listen to this tape over and over again, and I'll never get tired of it. I've given it to sponsees and hopes that they would, too, learn some of the things that I've learned from him. And okay. Without further ado, I'll go ahead and introduce the speaker, Vito.
I'm an addict called Vito. Hi, family. I'd like to thank the convention committee for giving me an opportunity to share here tonight. West Virginia has always been a good place for me. First time I've been down here in the lower panhandle, and I like the recovery, you know, that I see. I'm not going to give you a drug log because I stopped sharing my story quite a while ago. I really don't think it's necessary. The drugs that we use are all the same. We all have our own bottom. We have our pain, and I believe Narcotics Anonymous is about recovery and solution to all that, and that's what I want to share about is recovery. And what I have to share is strictly my experience, and everything that I share is not original. Everything that I share, I've learned in the rooms and come from you. So there's not going to be an original thought or anything that you're going to hear out of me. It's everything that I've learned from you and my experience of what I've learned from you. And I'm going to start, just to qualify very briefly, I started using in 1944. I'm from New York, and I stopped using in 1960. And that ended in a gutter in a place called Driftchurch Station in New Jersey. And at that time, I was suffering from both infectious and serum hepatitis. I didn't know what was wrong with me, except I had turned yellow. I lost consciousness, and I was laying in a gutter, and they rushed me to a hospital. And while I was in that hospital for the first 30 days, they kept me in an isolation ward because I had the infectious hepatitis, which was contagious, and they had to separate me from other people. And during that time, one of the interns that was taking care of me had come up to me and he told me, he says, Vito, that you have some stash on you, and the man wants to talk to you, and he has to wait for you to get out of isolation. However, I want to offer you something that, you know, you may be interested in. And being an addict, I'm always looking for a softer and easier way, and I listened to his proposition. He said, upstairs we have a place for people that have addiction problems. It's not for people exactly like you, because at that time there was no real rehabs or facilities for drug addicts, but it was what they called an alcoholic ward back then. And he says to me, if you're willing to sign yourself in there, even though it's not suffering from the same type of addiction you have, maybe the man might let you alone. And this was in the middle of February, and offering that to an addict when it's cold outside, I jumped at it. And I went upstairs for a place to hide for the rest of the winter because, you see, I didn't have a problem. I just felt that I abused drugs a little bit too much, but I didn't have a problem. And I didn't like the idea of being stuck with all these people that had problems because I figured they were weak, you know, and they weren't like me. And I really looked down on those people because I believed they had a problem and I didn't. And when I got there, I wasn't very friendly, and I wasn't really interested in what was going on. But two things happened while I was in that facility that changed my life. The first thing that happened to me, I got very friendly with an old man, and I use that word very cautiously because that man is probably the age I am today. But back then, he looked real old. And, you know, I looked at this man like, you ever meet these people, you can sit down, you can rap with them, and they know everything there is about everything, and you're just comfortable with them? And I looked up to him like a father figure or something along those lines. And, you know, I looked up to him, and I just gravitated towards him. The other thing that came in, this fellowship, and it wasn't this fellowship here, another fellowship was bringing meetings in. And, of course, those people had the problem, and I didn't. But what I liked about those people, they would get up there, and they would talk, and they handle themselves in a way that I always wished I could have. But I never could, because, you see, on the outside, I'd be Mr. Cool, and on the inside, I felt like a piece of shit all the time. But God forbid you find that out. But I liked the way they handled themselves, and they looked like they really were what they were acting like. But, of course, I didn't have a problem. And one day, this fella that I got very friendly to was being discharged. And back then, in these type places, he had a dress in hospital garb. And he had to go into the back room to get his street clothes. And when he came out, he was dressed as a Skid Row bum. And that sort of shattered me. And that was the first time that I was able to correlate the fact that I wasn't much different than him. When they had brought me in, I had probably lived in the streets about 6 or 7 months. My hair was matted. I had holes in my shoes. I probably hadn't slept in a bed in at least 6 months. And I realized that I was no different than this man. My only difference between me and him was our drug of choice was different. So I began to listen to these people when they brought the message in. And, you know, I begin to identify at a level of feelings, and I could relate to a lot what they had to say. And when it was time for me to leave that place, I was still homeless, but these people gave me a meeting list, and they told me that I should go to meetings. And when I got out, I had no place to go but these meetings. But when I showed up, something happened to me that happened to me all my life. They told me I was different. And it brought all these old feelings up, because when I went to school, they told me I was different. I was mentally retarded, and I didn't fit in, and they put me in special classes and wore gun caps. And all my life, I was different. You know, I hung around with older kids, and I was the neighborhood clown because I wanted to fit in, and I always felt different. And I walked into this meeting, and they told me I didn't have the kind of problem they had. I was different. My disease was one that was moral and social, and I didn't belong there, and they asked me to leave. And they physically escorted me out. They told me people like me just don't get better. But they went to that meeting list, and they circled these meetings that were open, and they were big speaker meetings, and they told me I was welcome there, but chances were it wouldn't do me any good, because people like me just never get better. We just die. And I immediately copped the resentment. And it's probably the only resentment that ever worked on my side, because they told me I couldn't get better and not to come back, and I kept coming back. And these meetings were huge, and I never had any problem getting a seat. I'd walk into a meeting that would be about half this size, and I would sit down, and everybody would move away. I guess people believe that you can catch your addiction, you know, just in the way. But I stood in those rooms for almost 5 years, and something happened during that period of time. More and more people like me begin to come in. You know, they say water seeks its own level. We sort of congregated together. But the strange thing is we never talked to each other except be cool and hi, how you doing? You know, we knew nothing about each other, but we sort of knew that we belonged together. And during that time, I got a nickname. I was called Animal, because they told me that drug addicts were nothing more than animals, and after 5 years, I began answering to that name. And one day, I was sitting in a meeting in the Vailsburg section of Newark, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, Animal, there's a drug meeting in the back room." Now, I had no idea what a drug meeting was, but it certainly felt like something I should look into after sitting there for 5 years and not opening my mouth. So myself and a herd of animals, we went into this back room. I guess we all considered ourselves animals then. And there was a strange sight, but if you lived through the 1960s, a lot of the older people remember the hippies or love children of the 1960s. There was a bunch of people in there, five or six of them. The guys had real long painted shirts, and the women had the long dresses and all kinds of flowers in their hair. They were the love children of the 60s. And what they were doing, they were going cross country from commune to commune, and these were recovering hippies that were trying to carry a message that they had picked up in their hometown, San Diego, California. And they had stopped over in a commune that was in a place called Morristown, New Jersey, and they hit this meeting in Newark, and they called themselves Narcotics Anonymous. And they were sitting around the table, and there wasn't very many readings back then like we have today. But they opened this meeting up, and they begin to share. And I call that the first day of my life, because for the first time in my life, I found out I was not unique and different. All my life, I thought that there was only one person in this whole world that was like me, and there was something wrong with me, and nobody ever thinks the crazy thoughts that I had. And God forbid if you ever found out my secret, because on the outside, I'm going to look like I've got it all put together. I'm cool, but on the inside, I was afraid you're going to find out I was full of shit. And these people begin to share, and I identify with them, and I found out they were sharing what I was thinking. And they allowed us locals to start sharing. And I found out the guys that I was sitting in the room, the ones that were just as cool as me and didn't open their mouth, were no different than me and had the same fears that I had. And we created a bond that day. And we tried to keep the meetings going after these hippies had left, and we weren't able to do it. We had some clean time, but we had no recovery. We had no structure. And we tried keeping the meetings together. And back then, there were some laws around that were called Rockefeller laws, that if two addicts congregated together, whether you're using or not, you got busted. And we even tried secret meetings in houses, and they just didn't work. But I kept in contact with one of these hippies who had gone back to San Diego, and he asked me to come out and join him. And when I went out to San Diego, I figured I'd have a lot of this Narcotics Anonymous, because I really identified, and there was only two meetings in the city of San Diego at that time. But the people who went to those meetings stuck together like glue. And they had to go to other places for their recovery. But after that, they would go to restaurants and diners, and they would talk Narcotics Anonymous. And I finally asked this one man to sponsor me, who was one of those hippies, because I had been in a program of recovery for over 5 years, and I had not worked any steps, and I had not had a sponsor, and I had a do-it-yourself type program, which just simply meant stay clean, because those people told me I couldn't stay clean. The first thing this man had said to me, he says, "Vito, where are you with the steps?" I said, "I work them all. I hear them read at meetings all the time." And he just looked at me with that dumb look, and he said, "Wrong." And that's when he told me that my disease was right between my ears. You know, because he said to me, he said, "Vito, what's the first step?" And I said, "I'm powerless over drugs and my life has become unmanageable." And he looked at me and he said, "Wrong, show me the word drugs." And I picked up a piece of paper and I read, "We're powerless over our addiction and our life has become unmanageable." And he said, "Where's the word drugs?" I said, "Addiction, drugs, same thing." He just laughed at me. He says, "That funny little thing between your ears is what addiction's all about. The disease of attitude, the personality, a negative outlook on life." And what he did, he put it all on me, and I looked at him, and I said, "You mean I'm the problem?" He says, "You got it." What he did, he closed my back door, because, you know, as an addict, I always wanted a back door. But it began to make sense, you see, because I had over 5 years of abstinence, but I was no better than the day I walked in. I still waited for people to relapse so I could roll them. I mean, that's being pretty sick. And I really had to take a look at that my problem was me, you see, because I had 5 years, and I white-knuckled it every day. Every day I wanted to use, and something was wrong. And I really had to take a look at that. And I did admit that I was the problem. And that's when he told me, he says, "Vito, stop putting all kinds of labels on me." Because back then, I used to be a cross-addicted, drug addict, alcoholic, dope fiend junkie. I figured the more labels I had, the badder I was. And that's when he told me, "Keep it simple. Identify as an addict only, because it covers everything." And I do that to this day. You see, because if I'm a drug addict and I'm an alcoholic, I'm sort of insinuating I have two diseases. And I'm putting the focus on the chemical rather than on the disease, and I am the disease. So I identify as addict only. Then he moved me on to a second step, you know, and I thought this was the step where you get down on your knees and pray or something like that, and I had a problem with that because I was an agnostic, and I said, whoa, I'm not into this God stuff. He looked at me and he said, show me the word God in the second step. I looked at it and said, we came to believe that the power greater than ourselves will restore us to sanity. I said, power greater than ourselves? He said, that's not God, dummy, you don't meet him till the third step. This guy was blowing my mind. Every time I had a back door, he kept shutting them behind me. What he told me, he said, in my addiction, chemicals were a power greater than myself. It had complete control and power over me. And in my recovery, anything that makes me aware of the insanity of doing the same thing over and over again and expecting it to be different was a power greater than myself. And that could be a literature, that could be something I read, something somebody shares with me, something a sponsor shares with me, anything that makes me stop and look at the insanity of doing the same thing over and over again and expecting it to be different. And he told me, even if the word said God and that God don't open the skies and send herds of angels down, he works through people, places, and things, so I would find that power greater than myself through people, places, and things. And that made sense to me. I became willing then to work that step. Because, see, I still wasn't going to get on my knees and pray. And he said, time for the third step. And I said, mm-mm. And he said, mm-hmm. See, I said to him, I said, you don't understand. I'm an agnostic. And he just looked at me and he said, why aren't you an atheist? And I had to think about that for a while. But I said, just in case there's a God, I want to say that. He didn't. You know, shut him out. And he said, mm-hmm. And I got thinking. But what he told me, he says, go to the end of the third step and read what it says. And it says, God as we understand him. And he says, you don't have to have the same God as anybody else. And that's why it says that. And he says, for you, Vito, he says, in the position that you're in, why don't you just take G-O-D, good orderly direction, and let that be the God of your own understanding. Because my back door away again, I had to work the step. But he introduced me to something then that I hated then, I hate today, and everybody I sponsor hates, and it's called pencil, paper, and dictionary. That's when he put me in school. He told me to get a good dictionary and look up the word decision, life, and will. And I was amazed how much of the English language that I didn't know. I looked up the word decision. There was a couple, you know, different definitions in there. And one of them was a point of action, a place to start. And that sort of made sense with the step. But where I really got my education is when I looked up the word life. And there were two or three definitions. One was to breathe. One was to be alive. And the third one seemed to fit. Things that occur in a lifetime. Then when I looked up the word will, one of the definitions was reaction to things that happen to you. The step now begins to make sense. So I said to him, well, can I be like everybody else then, take all my problems, turn it over, and let God work it out and do what I want to do? Because back then in the program, everybody would be walking around saying, well, turn it over, turn it over. You know, I thought it was a good idea. I'd go out and create shit and turn it over. And he told me I had to learn how to read because it says turn it over to the care of, and that made a big difference. It's like you got a couple kids and you're going out on Saturday night, you turn the kids over to the care of God. I mean, to the care of the babysitter. You don't turn them over to the babysitter, you come back in the evening and take the kids back. And what I was to do was to take my life and my will and turn it over to the care of God as I understood him. And about that same time, he was in the whole thing about, you know, Vito, don't you think it's about time you got to work, or you got a job, stop hustling nine ball and robbing people? You know, you're supposed to be about steps. And I work at the third step, so I had the answer for him. When it's God's will for me to get a job, he'll give me a sign. So he had to close that back door. He says, Vito, either God's will for you today, tomorrow, and 100 years from now is to be as mature and responsible as you can for where you are in your recovery, and the results will be as mature and responsible as they possibly can from where you are in your recovery. I said, huh? You should get a job. Well, I was starting to get better. The obsession to use was leaving, and I did not want to pick up at that time. And I went and I got a job. And I didn't like what I was doing. I was washing dishes for a living, and it was better getting a welfare check. But I did want to get better, and I started to take direction. You see, now I had these first three steps, and they were beginning to work in my life, and I wanted to be like the elite in the program, because these people that would come to meetings and share, I'm working the fourth step, they sound like, well, they were really into their recovery, and I wanted to be like them. So I says to my sponsor, I've worked the first three steps, put me on the fourth step. And he says, wrong, learn to live the first three steps. And this went on for quite a while. I would bug him almost on a daily basis, well, I want to do my fourth step. He says, you got to learn to internalize the first three steps. They're the foundation. They're the key to the program. And, you know, of course, being an addict, you know, I didn't want to work the steps for 5 years, and all of a sudden I wanted to go, boom, right through them. So I kept bugging him. So finally he gave me permission to do the fourth step. 24 hours later, I was done with it. He just looked at me, shook his head, and said, there's a Catholic church down around the corner if you want to go to confession. So what we want, Vito, he said, we want your history. We want the things that you had put into it. He said, but what I want you to do is to go back and write about that history, how you felt when you were creating that history, and how you feel about that history today. And what that will do is tell me where you were and where you are today, so I'll know during the fifth step where you have to go. And I went back. And I took that history and I wrote to the best of my ability how I felt when that history was occurring, what my attitudes were, what my feelings were, why I did it. And then I wrote how I felt about those actions today. And it did give me a good chance for me to get to know myself. Because you see, I could think back over the past and everything, but all I was doing was glancing over it. When I had to sit down and get into my feelings, how I felt and why I did those things and how I felt about them today, I got a pretty good idea of who I was today. So I really got into this bug of writing, and I created this beautiful manuscript. It was yay thick. And I figured when this man sits down with me, I have a captive audience for 24 hours. So we went out to the, it's like arid hills south of the city of San Diego towards Tijuana. And I take all these papers, we're sitting on rocks out there, and I'm ready to begin reading my fifth step, and he says, put those papers down, I don't want you to read them, I don't want you to look at them. And I immediately got totally angry. Here's all this time, investment, my ego is in there, I dare you tell me to put them down. And he explained to me the whole thing of writing that fourth step was for me to get to know myself. Now we're going to talk about what I had written. And he allowed me to glance at the titles and begin talking about it. And today I realize why, because three times as much came out of my mouth that was on paper. What I was doing was priming my memory and getting in touch with my feelings to share all this stuff. And today when I do a fifth step with somebody, that's what I do. I don't go for the reading. We talk about what's been written. And what happened is, I believe that spiritual awakening that they talk about in the fifth step was very simply, I got to know myself a little better, I shared it with another human being and God of my own understanding, and I knew where I had to go, because I didn't get the spiritual awakening. I hear people share at meetings, I still hear today, that I did this fifth step and this big tons were lifted from me. That did not happen with me. All I felt was relieved that it was finally done. And I didn't have all this great feeling. But what had happened weeks and even months after I had did the fifth step, things had changed in my life, and I attribute that to the fifth step, because things begin to change automatically after I did a fifth step. Things seem to fall in place, because I had a lot of the answers why I was the way I was and where I needed to go. And I think that's really why the sixth step follows the fifth step. You know, where they talk about, we became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects. And I said to my sponsor, is this where you pray and he takes all the bullshit away? And he said wrong. He said there's nothing in that sixth step that says God removes these defects. What it says is Vito became entirely ready to have God do it. It wasn't God's step, it was my step. It was a step of preparation, it was a step of getting ready. And I had asked him, how do I become entirely ready? What is this whole thing? Do you pray about it or what? And he says, well, the first five steps were part of that process of becoming entirely ready. But what I need to do in the sixth step is take a piece of paper, draw a line right down the center, list all the defects that were identified in the fifth step on one side of that line and the patterns that go with them, and opposite on the other side of the line, write down the things that are opposite of the defects in the pattern. One side will show me where I'm at, the other side will show me where I need to go, and I now have a roadmap on recovery of what I need to work on. And when I went through that process, my sponsor said, I have become entirely ready. So he put me on the seventh step, and I said, is this where you get on your knees and he takes care of all this yet? And he's only wrong. He told me the seventh step is where I really begin to work. And I really didn't understand that until he explained to me. You know, I said, well, we humbly asked him to remove these shortcomings. He told me part of the humility or becoming humble is to admit that I have the problem, that the shortcoming is on me. You see, he said, I'm not responsible for my defects. A defect is a defective personality. It's like my disease. It's part of my makeup. But he said the shortcoming is different than the defect. The shortcoming is the acting out of the defect. And he says, when I own up to my shortcomings, that they're on me, they're my reactions, and nobody else's, because as addicts, you know, we're in a relationship. It's her fault I lost my temper. Or my boss wasn't fair. I have a right to act out. But when I own my shortcomings for acting out, I have become humble. Because any addict who admits that he's wrong is becoming humble. And what he told me is the way God removes these defects, these shortcomings, is through spiritual principles. Because God only works, no matter what your concept is, through spiritual principles. And the way you have to do it is through the first three steps. And he explained to me, because see, at that time, one of my biggest shortcomings was violent jealousy. And he explained to me that it's very normal for a human being to become jealous. There is nothing wrong with it. But to act in a jealous way, there's something wrong. And what I had to do was go through a first step and admit I'm powerless over the feeling of jealousy. Own it. Don't deny it. Don't fight it. Accept that I feel jealous. And then he told me to go to a second step and see the insanity if I act out on that feeling that I have. Then he told me to go to a third step and take that feeling and turn it over to the care of God as I understood him, praying for the strength and the courage to do it different, and then go back to a second step and do it different. Tell me to go 1, 2, 3, and back to 2. And every time I did it, he removed just for that time. And that's how God removed my shortcomings, by owning up to the way I feel, admitting it, and working spiritual principles on. And over a long period of time, that violent jealousy was removed from me. And that happened one day at a time by working that step to the best of my ability. And it took a long time. I did not work that step on it, and instantly it was gone. It took a long time. Today I don't have that problem. I can feel jealous, and I can admit that I feel jealous, and know the insanity if I act out on it, and just turn those feelings over. I'm not insensitive to the feelings. The feelings have not gone. The defect has not gone. But I do not have to act out on that shortcoming if I choose. But if I choose not to work the steps on some of the shortcomings, they're back in my life the same day as I walked into a program. And that happens. There are days that I work a program that amazes myself, and there's days my program is worse than somebody with 24 hours clean. And if my wife was here tonight, she can tell you. She shared at a convention last week in Utah. She was a spiritual speaker, and she explained how Vito goes into his pouting room when he's angry and closes the door. And that's what I do. If I don't work the steps, I get into my shit, and I go in my little pouting room, as I call it, and I close the door, and, you know, I stay in there till I get out of my shit. Because if I don't, I'm going to act out on it, because I'm not ready to let it go, and that's on me. The thing is, if I decided to work the steps on it, it'd be gone. But being an addict, sometimes I'm comfortable with my own pain. But if I keep coming back here, maybe someday a lot more of those shortcomings will disappear. But I realize that this is a lifetime program, and we don't get cured from it. I just try to strive for progress. When I got time to get to the eighth step, I told my sponsor, when I became willing, I would make the list. And he said, wrong. He said, read the steps. I picked it up and said, we became willing to make a list. We made a list, and then we became willing. He said, read it again. I said, we made a list, and then we became willing. He said, so make the list, then become willing. So I was accustomed to direction then, so I made the list and came back. I said, I'm still not willing. He said, yes, you are. You wouldn't have made the list. And I guess he was right. And now I know why the eighth and ninth step is eight and nine. Because I come to him with this list. And he said to me, he says, Vito, you did not come this far to crucify yourself. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, some of the things that you have on this list is going to get you into a lot of trouble. And he says, read what the ninth step says. He said, we made direct amends to all that we had injured or harmed. We made direct amends to all those we had harmed except when to do so would injure them or others. And he says, you're part of others, dummy. He said, when you make these amends, if it's going to injure another human being, it's not wise to make that thing, because part of recovery is not to hurt other people. And if you're going to hurt yourself, that isn't wise either. And he went over that list with me one by one. And I understand why we do a ninth step with somebody more experienced, because there were amends that I was told not to make. Because I couldn't determine that it would hurt somebody. I figured that I would go to these people and I would tell them what I did to them, and they would just love me to death for being so honest. And he went over that list and he says, these people don't know anything about what you did to them, and it wouldn't be wise, because all you would be doing is hurting them. So we went over all these things. And then I had on my list a category that said all those faceless people. You know, the people like ships passing in the dark, the people in the alleys, the people you never see again or never really knew. And he told me I just couldn't turn my back on them. Amends needed to be made. But he told me the way I make those amends is through my higher power. And if my higher power felt that I needed to make direct amends, he would put them in my life. And that has happened. People have come back into my life as much as 17 years later. And I didn't know who these people were, but I recognized what it was, and they recognized who I was. And I realized why it was kept out of my life that long, because at that point in my recovery, I could not handle making amends to them. I wasn't in that spot, and maybe they weren't in that spot. They may have killed me. But when my higher power felt that they were ready, they appeared. And I didn't know even their names or who they were or where they would be. But I know when they pop back up in my life, it was the time. And it worked out well. And that's happened to me a few times. And I believe today we do step nine at number nine, and the steps are done originally in a formal matter in that order, because there's a reason for it. And when we got time to do the tenth step, where we said we continue to take personal inventory, except when we're wrong, promptly admitted, or something along those lines, I figured I had this one made, because I could say thank you and I'm sorry just like that. And my sponsor looked at me and he said, Vito, you suffer from sorry-itis. Never say you're sorry again. And I looked at him and I couldn't understand what he was saying. He said, what they really mean is when you're wrong, promptly admit it. It's self-honesty. When you do something wrong, if you don't admit it to yourself that you've done it wrong and work it into your program for the next day because you're doing personal inventory of your day, you can't do anything about it. And saying I'm sorry and continuing to do it over and over again just doesn't cut it. And I said to him, well, there's times I really feel I need to apologize. He says, that's right, there's other ways of apologizing besides saying I'm sorry. And to this day, I do not use the word I'm sorry. I have other ways that I apologize. But I understand really what it means to take personal inventory and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Because when I do go over my day, I have to take a look at my day and the things that went wrong, that I was at fault. And I have to admit it to me to try not to do it again. And that doesn't always happen. I still do the same things over and over again. And I still create insanity in my life. But at least I work on it on a continual basis. And it does get better. Today I'm not making a lot of the same mistakes, or I'm making new mistakes. But I still make a lot of the same mistakes. And that's okay, because I'm a human being and I'm in a program of recovery. And they tell me it's okay to fall short, as long as I can own it. And I try to do that to the best of my ability. In the 11th step, when they talked about through prayer and meditation to try to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us today, my sponsor told me that we were doing that since the third step, and now we're formally working on improving that. And he told me the program does not tell us how to pray, and it doesn't tell us how to meditate. It tells us that we need to do it and improve on it. And I don't believe anybody in this program has a right to tell anybody else how to pray. And yet I hear people telling other people to get on their knees. And I see nothing wrong with getting on your knees if that's the God of your understanding and you're okay with it. But I believe a person has a right to improve their prayer and meditation to their own way. Personally, the way I meditate, I go for walks. I'm a walker. And I get in contact. And other people do it other ways. Some people have formal ways of meditation. And I think any way that we do it is the proper way for us, as long as we continue to do it. And I think praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out comes automatically if we do that. I think as long as we're searching to improve that prayer and meditation, the knowledge of His will for us at that particular time is brought to us somehow. And I think the knowledge of His will for us changes as we change. Because what I'm capable of doing today, I may not have been capable of doing 5 years ago. And what I'm not capable of doing today, maybe 5 years from now, I may be. And all I do is just keep coming back, and it gets better. And in the 12th step, what they say, as a result of these steps, we had a spiritual awakening. And they talk about, we carry this message to other addicts and practice these principles in all our affairs. I believe, for me, that spiritual awakening is very simply that these steps work. I think what it's saying in the 12th step is these steps work, and we carry the message of the steps to other addicts and practice them to the best of our ability. And that's all the 12th step is saying. Yes, that covers H and I work and chairing meetings and all that, because that's all part of carrying the message that the steps work. But I think that we don't really focus that much on carrying the message that the steps. Sometimes I go to meetings and I think I'm at Problems Anonymous and not Narcotics Anonymous. And I think all of our literature tells us in plain English that all we do at meetings is carry the message of recovery through the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. We carry the solution. Yes, it's okay to come to a meeting and share where you're at, what problems that you're at, but we should also share what we're doing about it. And yet I've seen when we come to a meeting, somebody shares a problem, and 10,000 people want to tell them how to cure it. We have 25 tin jobs. And I don't believe we're a rehab. I don't believe we give feedback at Narcotics Anonymous means. I believe we just share our personal experience, strength, and hope. And I believe the steps are necessary for my own personal recovery and any addict's personal recovery. But I personally believe that if we're working the steps in our life, we're only working half a program. I believe we have another set of principles, and a lot of people say service junkies and NA politicians and all that. And I don't believe that. I believe that everybody who walks into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous is a failure at relationships. We do not know how to have a relationship with another human being, let alone a male-female relationship. And I believe the 12 traditions teach us how to have relationships with other human beings. And they're written for the group because we learn how to have relationships in a group setting, but we take those spiritual principles of the traditions into our personal lives. But they talk about in the first tradition, our common welfare should come first, personal recovery depends on NA unity. Well, as far as our group is concerned, our common welfare is recovery from addiction, because that's the only thing we have in common. We come from different religions, different ethnic backgrounds, different races, different drugs of choice. We're different completely, but the one common bond we all have in common is we suffer from the same disease, no matter what we use. And that's our common welfare, to get better from that disease. And you see, if we focus on that common welfare, then unity is a byproduct. And unity does not mean harmony. Again, not knowing the English language, when I looked it up, unity means to be united. And if we have a common welfare, we're united in that common welfare to get better from the disease. So we focus on similarities rather than differences. And that's another reason why we identify all exclusively as addicts, so that we all be the same, because we're there for the same reason. We're not there for the chemicals. And if we take that same spiritual principle that we learned in the group setting, what the common welfare is for everybody in that group, and just think, if we took that common welfare and we brought it home into our family, and we asked what our common welfare is in our family unit, so that we have that unity, we've taken the first spiritual principle of relationships that we learned in the group setting, and we brought it into our personal program for our recovery for relationships. We learned the first rule of how to get along with other people. And we sit down and we talk with members of our family. What is our common welfare in our family? Generally, it's to keep the family unit together and go for whatever goals that family has. And we're beginning to learn that we have to communicate with others. And if we take that same principle on our job, we'll find the common welfare among all the workers. And so it's no longer them and us. And we learned it in the group. And then the second tradition, in the group setting, we learn there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God. If he may express himself in that group conscience, our leaders are but trusted servants. And that tells us what the ultimate authority is in our groups in Narcotics Anonymous. It's group conscience as it's expressed, not group will. And I think the basic text clears that up, that there's a difference between group will or group opinion and group conscience. Group conscience is anything that the majority of the group decides on that's within the 12 traditions. And group opinion or group will is what the majority of the group wants when it's violating traditions. And there's a big difference. And God does not express the ultimate authority in group will. He does in group conscience. And it tells us that we do have leaders in Narcotics Anonymous. It says our leaders are. But it also explains what they are. Trusted servants. Trusted to carry that ultimate authority, group conscience. They do not govern. Look up the word govern in the dictionary, to make decisions for others. Our leaders are trusted to carry the ultimate authority, group conscience. They do not make decisions for us. And yet I hear in groups, they'll tell the GSR, well, we'll give you a vote of confidence. You're allowing them to govern. And then everybody bitches when things go wrong. He did it. We have a responsibility to have our trusted servants carry the ultimate authority, group conscience. And if we take that same principle and bring it into our family, you know, most male addicts, when they get into a relationship with a woman, is the man is the master, the ego, the macho, and all that. You know, and it makes relationships not work. And if we take that second tradition and we look about group conscience in our families, well, we sit down with our spouses and we have a conscience on what you think, and if the children are old enough to reason that they're included in the group conscience, we have a loving God express an ultimate authority in our families. And the so-called head of the family is nothing more than the trusted servant to carry out the wishes of the entire family. And we've learned the second principle in relationships through the group.
You see, if we only work the steps, we're only working on us. If we learn to get involved in the groups, but yeah, I don't want to belong to all those business meetings. They do nothing but argue. Well, I got news for you. We go home and argue, and we go on the job and argue. We better learn how to do it in a constructive way. And we learn it through the traditions. They're guidelines. And they tell us in the third tradition, the only requirement for membership is desire to stop using. A few years ago, it used to say an honest desire. Thank God we changed it, because who the hell are we to judge what's honest? He's not really honest. He can't be a member here. Just a desire to stop using. That means that we're all equal. Nobody's greater or lesser. You know, when you come right down to it, a person who is still relapsing and actively using can be a member of this fellowship if they have a desire to stop using and keep coming back. What the hell else would they be in the room for if they didn't have the desire? They may not be able to serve, because we do have guidelines of what requires to speak or chair a meeting. They could be exempt from them because they don't have the clean time requirements. But they certainly can be a member if they have a desire to stop using and they keep coming back. And yet I see relapsers come back and people in the room say, what are you doing here? You don't really want it. Well, I'll tell you, if I relapse, it takes a hell of a lot of pride to get out of the way to walk back in those rooms. And if relapsers come back, I respect them. As a matter of fact, if you look around the rooms with people with long-term clean time, many of those people were relapsers when they first came in. And then when they put it together, program, we make up at the end. We learn to disagree eventually without just being disagreeable, and that don't happen right away, believe me. I mean, in my home group, they still tell me to sit down and shut my mouth and get my self-will out of the way. You see, I have a home group, and I keep going back every month, and they know me well enough to tell me that. I become part of. If I didn't have a home group to participate, those people wouldn't know me well enough. And when I don't show up at my home group, and I don't say where I'm going to be if I have another commitment, I guarantee somebody knocks on my door and wants to know what's wrong. Or if I sit there with a long face, they say, what's wrong with you? Nothing. Get off that shit. See, these people know me better than anybody else, because they're involved with me on a monthly basis at the business meeting. They know my good points and they know my bad points. And I really believe that if you don't have a home group, you're not a member of Narcotics Anonymous, you're a visitor. I don't know about anybody in this room. Do you know anybody who joined Narcotics Anonymous? I know people that joined Narcotics Anonymous groups, but I don't know anybody who joined Narcotics Anonymous. So you come in, you say, well, I'm a member of Narcotics, a member of what? See, yes. The decision rests with the individual. You're a member when you say you are, but that means walking up to a group secretary and saying, I want to become part of this group and be what you're all about. The decision rests on the individual. We don't turn anybody away. They disqualify themselves. Say, I go to NA meetings. I'm a member. Well, what did you join? If you don't have a home group, you're a visitor. Where do you cast your vote in Narcotics Anonymous? Where do you become part of? And again, when we become part of a group, we're learning how to have a relationship. We're becoming part of, even if things happen that we don't like. We learn how to surrender, and it enhances our steps. And then we get into the fourth tradition, where it says each group is autonomous and steps that matters affecting other groups or NA as a whole. And how many times do we hear that, Delphine? Each group is autonomous. We'll do what the hell we want. Forget about the rest, except when to do so would affect other groups or NA as a whole. And that very simply means that if you're breaking the traditions, you're affecting other groups in the area or NA as a whole. In the basic text, it says, when that happens for that second, that minute, that group ceases to be an NA group. Yes, a group is autonomous. It can do anything it wants within the 12 traditions, as long as it doesn't affect adversely NA as a whole or the other groups. can have the kind of formats it wants, the kind of readings it wants. It's autonomous in that area, but it's not autonomous to do anything it wants. It can do anything it wants within the 12 traditions. And isn't that true if we take that spiritual principle home? Each member of the family is an autonomous person. We're individuals, and we can do anything we want within the family unit except when to do so would affect any of the other members of the family. And where did we learn that? By participating in a home group. And when we go to work, we're individuals. We're autonomous at work, except when to do so would affect any other member of that job. And we're learning how to get along with other people, and we're getting better in spite of ourselves, providing we have a home group and we participate in these traditions. And we take them serious. So that's for NA politicians, service junkies. It's for individuals. Yes, they're written for the group so that addicts can learn those principles in the groups and take them home. And it tells us in the fifth tradition, our primary purpose is to carry the message to the addict that still suffers. And everybody in this room tonight is an addict that still suffers. Because we all suffer to different degrees. And our primary purpose as a home group member for the group is to make sure that that group has an atmosphere of recovery, not an atmosphere of problems, an atmosphere of recovery so that we can all get better together, that we have the meeting organized into the fact that there is a topic, if it's a topic meeting, not the leader of the meeting coming up and say, well, I haven't picked a topic for tonight. I only had a week to think about it. Anybody know what we're going to talk about? To spend 10 minutes on that. It's up to the group to make sure who's ever sharing the meeting has a speaker or the topic and to keep that atmosphere in recovery so we can get there and do what we're doing, getting better. And then we do the same thing in our families. What's our primary purpose in our families? Whatever our goals are. We learn that. The same thing in our jobs. And the sixth tradition tells us how not to divert from the fifth tradition, how not to divert from our primary purpose. And they talk about through endorsement and through money, property, and prestige. And what is an endorsement? The basic text says there are two types, direct and implied. A direct endorsement, we know what that is. Have the traditions and the steps of another fellowship hanging on the wall while our meeting's going on. That don't mean they're bad, but it means that it's not Narcotics Anonymous and it should be covered during the meeting. Because it diverts us from what our steps and traditions are. If we use literature or books of another fellowship, that's an implied endorsement because that's saying that that belongs during our meeting. Other fellowships literature is great. People have been getting better with it for 50 years, but it belongs there and ours belongs where we are. And it needs to be covered or removed during our meeting. And it talks about, a second from the last paragraph in the text, that we need not have speakers from other fellowships. And that's misunderstood. That does not mean if a person goes to two fellowships, they cannot speak in Narcotics Anonymous. What it simply means, if they speak in Narcotics Anonymous, they speak of their recovery through Narcotics Anonymous only. Because if they speak about their other recovery, what they're doing is giving an implied endorsement. Not that that's bad, but it doesn't belong here. And our message doesn't belong there. Because as I said, people have recovered other places for over 50 years and they have a good message. And if a person needs that message, they need to go there. And when I come here, I need to hear this message because I recover here in Narcotics Anonymous. And the traditions are there to guarantee not to divert from the fifth tradition. It has nothing to do with NAPD, which I hear people talking about. There are some addicts who can't go anyplace else to get better. They're only comfortable in Narcotics Anonymous, and I happen to be one of those addicts. But also, when in the business I'm in, there's times I travel, and I can't find an NA meeting, and I have to go somewhere else, and I respect their traditions and identify the way they do and use their language, because I'm going to be part of, recovery tells me to respect guidelines. When I speak, I only use the language that is found in Narcotics Anonymous literature because I believe using another fellowship's language is an implied endorsement. And I'll tell you how that came about because I was one of the holdoffs. I was around before the basic text And I grew up with the language of another fellowship, and I used the word sober and sobriety all the time. And when the NA language came out, I did not want to change. And I could not see why, because I said I got better under the old way. Why should I have to change? It wasn't that important. And one day a newcomer came up to me after an NA meeting, and he says, "Vito, let's go over to the other fellowship." And I looked at him. I said, "I don't go anyplace else but Narcotics Anonymous." And he looked at me. He says, "Vito, you talk their talk. They must have the real deal." And I understand what they meant by implied endorsement, and I stopped using the language of another fellowship from that day on. But I'll tell you, if need be to go to another fellowship's meeting, if I'm out of town and can't find NA, I'll use their language there and not our language, because I have to learn to respect their fellowship. And that's part of growth. And for me, at one time, I wanted to make them us. I wondered why they didn't like me. And I've grown from them, and I've learned from there. And the seventh tradition tells us that we have to be self-supporting. I know when I came into recovery, I was not self-supporting. I waited for that check from the state every month, twice a month to be exact. And I didn't know how to take care of myself. But by being part of a group, and putting that money in the basket and realizing that that group has to pay rent, buy coffee, buy literature, and donate to the area so that the phone line could be on and there's PI work, and putting my fair share in, I learned to pay my bills. And my sponsor told me what my fair share was. So I said to him, I said, "What's a fair share to put into the basket?" Because I used to throw a quarter in and spend $4 in the diner after the meeting. And he looked at me one day and he said, "What's your life worth?" And I started putting the money in the basket and buying coffee afterwards. I learned what my priorities were. I have to pay for my recovery. And it taught me to pay my bills, because I took that spiritual principle and I brought it into my family, and I found out that I had to take the priorities in that family and pay them first before I had luxuries for me. The kids had to eat. They had to have clothing. The bills had to be paid. The rent had to be paid. Then Vito can take money in his pocket and go out to the diner with the people. And I learned that by putting it in the basket and through my home group. I've learned that spiritual principle. And that's an important part in relationships, because how many relationships did we burn because we took money that belonged in the home and we burned it in recovery? We went out and we spent on ourselves when it needed to be paying the bills. But when we learn our home group comes first, we learn our families come first. And in our eighth tradition, it talks about that we have no professionals in there, you know, but our service centers may employ special workers. You know, each and every one of us is a professional in the outside world, no matter what we do. But when we walk into Narcotics Anonymous, we're equal. None of us are any greater or lesser. Yeah, we have special workers to do special jobs. Service officers have office managers, clerks, telephone answers, World Service Office has coordinators. These are special workers to do work. But they're not professionals. They're just people being paid to do that. But in that meeting, we're all equal. It doesn't matter if we're rich or poor. Whether we're a counselor in a rehab or a lawyer or a doctor or a factory worker, we're all equal. And when we walk into our families and we find out we're all equal, she's not just the housewife and I'm the provider, we're equal. We learn a very important part of relationships. And if two people are working in the family, then we learn that we have to be equal there. We both have to share into whatever the duties of the house is. It's not one person's job, it's all of our jobs. And we learn that through that eighth tradition. And the ninth tradition, to me, is a lot like the fourth tradition. It gets dope-fiend. It says NA as such ought never be organized but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. What is NA as such? I believe NA as such is a recovery meeting, and that should never be organized. That's there to share our experience, strength, and hope through the 12 steps. That's NA as such, but NA as such may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. And the first committee or service board they create? Is the group steering committee, the GSR, the treasurer, secretary? And what they do is they create that so that they don't have to do that business during NA as such. Can you imagine stopping a recovery meeting and calling for group conscience? We can't organize that, but we set up the first level, the steering committee of the group. And those steering committees get together with other steering committees and set up the area who are responsible to those groups. And those areas get together and set up a region, and that region is responsible to the area who's responsible to the groups. The regions get together and set up the conference, and the conference is responsible to the regions who are to the areas, to the groups, to the addicts. And therefore, our highest level of service, as we call it, is directly responsible back to the addict, providing the addict has a home group and participates. So how many people don't even bother with the agenda report and they say, look what them guys did. Those guys didn't do nothing. We did it by either lack of knowledge or not participating. There's nothing that happens in Narcotics Anonymous that's self-willed, even though people think they do. Say, those people in California are self-willing stuff, and that's not true. Our lack of involvement allows things to happen. Nobody self-wills. And if we don't participate, don't bitch. That's simple. You see, all those boards are accountable to us if we are accountable and participate. And doesn't that teach us to take that spiritual principle and bring it into our homes? Sure, we can set up one person to pay the bills and another person to do these chores. These are all sort of committees that we're doing within the home. But they're accountable to everybody in that family. The person that pays the bills, just because they pay the bills doesn't mean they're not accountable to the other members of that family. We learn that through the ninth condition. And we have that equality in our homes, which becomes another spiritual principle in relationships we learn in the home group through the traditions. And our tenth tradition tells us we have no opinion on outside issues. Hence the NA name ought never be drawn into controversy. And that's true. We don't have any opinions with what the DA is doing or the task force on drugs or what a rehab's doing or what another fellowship's doing. We could give a damn what they're doing. They're outside issues. The way they identify in a rehab, that's their business. The way they identify in another fellowship, that's their business. When it comes into our rooms, then that's an inside issue. That's not an outside issue. But what they're doing is there. Can you imagine going into a rehab and telling them how to run their program? That's their business. It's an outside issue. But the same token, when those rehab people come to our meeting, that's an inside issue. We do have an opinion. And yet I've seen that dope feed. We don't really give a damn what anybody does outside the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. That is an outside issue. We don't need to get involved in that. The only thing we're concerned about is what goes on in here. And that only happens if we participate. And isn't that true in our families? If we would concentrate on what our family's doing and not what the other families are doing. Look what the Smiths are doing. They're real sick over there. That's an outside issue. We need to concentrate what's going on in our homes. And we learn to have relationships with one another. And we've learned that through our home group in Narcotics Anonymous. And I think the 11th tradition, I think the basic text says that the best. It says CPI manual. Because as addicts, we're not qualified dealing with the public. You know, we've tried it and we've goofed up things. We have people in public information that are specialized in that. I think the best thing for me is to be the best addict as I possibly could, and that's the best PI work that I can do. It tells us what our public relation policy is based on attraction rather than promotion, that we must maintain personal anonymity at the level of Quest Radio and film. And that's the only place where it talks about personal anonymity in the traditions, is at the level of Quest Radio and films. And we're not qualified to do that, and that's why we have public information. We just do the best we can as individuals and live the best life that we can. And that's a lot of attraction if we're working a program. And I think the 12th tradition is like the 12th step. It sums everything up that we've talked about. It says anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Well, when they talk about anonymity being the spiritual foundation, that happened in the first tradition. You see, when we focused on our common welfare, getting better from the disease of addiction, we just created anonymity. We're all the same. And when it says that's the spiritual foundation of all of our principles, well, what does Webster say that anonymity is? state of bearing no name. So that simply means that when a person walks into a meeting, they're not male, they're not female, they're not white, black, or red, they're not rich, they're not poor, they're just addicts. You see, if a good-looking girl walks into the meeting, and we look at her like she's a piece of meat to hit on, we just violated her anonymity. She's not an addict. Number one, she can't get better. She can't get better, and we can't get better. Because the whole meeting, we're looking at that newcomer we're going to hit on before she gets too well to know what's going on. Or if the rich guy comes in and he pulls up in his BMW or Mercedes and we focus on him as being the rich guy, that makes him different. See, if we focus on anonymity, we're all the same, nothing more than addicts, and that's another reason why we identify as addicts only. Then we can all get better together. And if we focus on the principle of getting better, then the personality doesn't even get in it. And it'll always be principles before personalities automatically if we practice that anonymity. That's why when I identify, I say I'm an addict called Vito, because I place the principle of me being an addict before my personality to remind me that that 12th tradition is a vital part of my life. You see, when I take that into my home and allow that anonymity to come between me and my wife and other members of the family, and we're all equal, if not master and slave. So many of us come in with those street attitudes that I can't speak for the women, but I can speak for the men, that we run our house, we are the man, which is a bunch of bullshit. We need that anonymity in our home. And guess what? Our relationships begin to work. You know, we go and we keep getting it. I've gone through three marriages in recovery. The marriage I'm in now is my third marriage, and it took me three marriages to find out that I need to have anonymity. I couldn't figure why my marriages and my relationships kept ending up. Because I would get into them, and it had to be 100% my way. There was no anonymity. And then I realized the principles I've learned in the group need to be brought into my life, and my marriage today is working. Because I'm using spiritual principles. And these things are all part of relationships with ourselves and with other human beings. And all this is great. I knew all this stuff. And you know what? I had something like 15 or 17 years clean, and I knew all this stuff. And I was married to a girl at that time that was a nun addict. And she used to say to me all the time, "Why do you go to those meetings? Why do you hang with those people from that side of the track?" See, I've been around for a while, and I got this good job. I was a national sales manager, and I had this big $100,000 home, and the Cadillac, and the Chrysler New Yorker, and all this stuff, you know. And she would say, "You need to belong to the Rotary, or the Kiwanis, and all this good stuff." Well, this addict loved to hear that stuff. So I stopped going to meetings. First, I cut down like one meeting a week, one a month. You see this all the time with people with time. Then once every 2 months, one every 6 months, all of a sudden I stopped going to meetings. I didn't go to a meeting for 6 years. I stayed clean. I didn't know something was happening, but something happened. The same thing when I was a newcomer. My feelings were closed. I began to suffer. And then one day a major crisis happened in my life. See, I figured I graduated from the 12-step academy and I could handle anything. But I had a problem with one of my daughters, and I couldn't handle it. And I began to feel all those street things back. It was like the Pied Piper was out there, and he was calling me. And I recognized those feelings right away. I did not want to feel, and I couldn't stop feeling, and I wanted to self-medicate. And if I knew that if I left that house and put a needle in my arm, I knew I wasn't coming back. I knew it. I felt it. But I couldn't stop the feeling. And I thought to myself, you know, the typical addict without a program. Lock myself in the room, self-will, morning will come and I'll be okay. And I locked myself in that room and I banged my head on the walls and I put my fist through it. And the sun came up in the morning and that Pied Piper was still out there calling me. And I was afraid to go out because I knew what would happen to me. So I figured, bullshit, if I'm not going to feel, I'm going to take the biggest escape forever. And I tied a rope around my neck. And I hung myself. They tell me I was clinically dead. The girl that I was married to at that time had cut me down, got the ambulance there, and they tell me I was clinically dead, and they brought me back. And I was living in Pennsylvania at that time, and there's a law in the state of Pennsylvania that says that if you try to take your own life, they can commit you for observation or whatever the stuff is they do. And I had to go before a psychiatrist to be evaluated. And thank God to this day that this woman's psychiatrist understood the disease of addiction, because after we talked for about 2 hours, she says, Leo, you're a little nuts like everybody in the world. She said, but your biggest problem is you're an addict without a program. And she told me that she wouldn't commit me, providing that I would promise to get myself to a meeting. And I not only went to a meeting, I ran to get there. My first sponsor had told me something once: when you're green, you're growing. When you're right, you begin to rot. And I understand when I begin to rot. I got right. See, the first time around, I didn't get involved that much in service. That was for other people to do. I didn't give nothing away. I took. I was what I call an NA thief, and we have plenty of them around. They come and take and take and take, and then they don't give anything back and they disappear. And I was an NA thief. This time I was going to make it different. I was going to stay green, and I got involved in service. I got involved with the home group that I have today, and I've had the same home group since 1978. I got involved in my area. I'm involved in my region because I need to do that. I go to 4 meetings a week, and people have said to me, Vito, with the amount of time that you have, why do you go to 4 meetings a week? I think you're hiding in meetings. And I look them right in the eye, and I say, I go to meetings because I want to learn how to live on life on life's terms. I have people working for me. I have a lot of money to go through my hands through the company that I work through, and I have a big budget. And I do live life on life's terms, and I'm not hiding. But I come into the rooms to recharge my battery, to learn how to live with my weaknesses, because I have them. I'm an addict. I want to run when things get real bad. And instead of running, I come into the rooms and explain how I'm feeling. And I hear my own answers come out of my own mouth. But I just needed to sound it. And I learn how to do those things by participating in my home group. I'm involved in my region. The area I belong to the Greater Philadelphia region. And I feel it's one of the better regions in the country. Because we practice traditions there. We learn to disagree without being disagreeable. We argue, we fight, we throw things. Thank you. But we hug and we get things done. In our area, I feel the same way. There's a lot of times, most of the meetings in the area I belong to, I started. Because when I moved to that town, there was only one meeting, my home group. And I'm like every other addict. I didn't want to give up control. I wanted to be a member of every home group in there. We only have one home group. And they learned to tell me to get the hell out of their business meetings. I don't belong there. And we have an ASR that keeps me on my toes, because he calls me on my shit all the time. But you see, that's the stuff that keeps me green. And that's the stuff that keeps me getting better. See, when I used to think I was getting better, I was getting sicker. Today I realize that I'm sick forever, but it can be arrested, and I can get better on a daily basis if I keep coming back, because you people are the reason I get better. Thanks for letting me share. I love you.